Well, the last problem that I have with analysis that I was speaking of is that once you do your linguistic analysis and you've gained clarity, there's still a philosophical question that has to be asked, and what's the nature of that clarity? Have you reached subjective clarity or objective clarity? That is, are you clear in what you're saying? Or you feel that you're clear in what you're saying because you're subjectively satisfied with it? Or is it because you've finally gotten down to the bottom of things and objectively have reached clarity about the world, how you live your life, and how you know what you know? Clarity is not an end in itself unless you are sure that the clarity you have is objective. It's the way things really are in the world. Subjective clarity, subjective confidence, hey, we can have plenty of people that have that without going through the route of analysis at all, right? And this leads me into some of my concluding assessments about the history of philosophy. It'd really be glorious if all of you at this point had heard all of the lectures so you had a sense of what's building up to this. But Jay and others who by tape maybe have been listening to these lectures, where did philosophy begin? Way, 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 way back in misty murks of history. Well, it began with some people believing one thing and some people believing another, and now we interact with each other trying to find out who's right about the nature of reality. How do we know what we know, and how should we live our lives? There are plenty of people who thought they had it. They were clear. But as they came up against cross-examination, their convictions didn't prove to be so clear, and so forth. If we've gone the whole history of philosophy, and you don't want to hear all of it all over again, but just imagine through all those ages, all those schools of thought, all those philosophers, and we come down finally to the ordinary language philosophers who tell us, well, we've gained clarity in the use of our language. And the question is, well, then, are we clear about things as they are, really, or just clear subjectively? We're right back to the beginning of philosophy, aren't we? Now, one might want to just, in desperation, say Nietzsche was right. It's eternal recurrence, isn't it? Just these huge cycles. We've gone the whole route, and rather than advancing through man's humanistic autonomous intellect to final answers and solutions, we're right back to the beginning. We're right back to scratch. So that would be my third reply to ordinary language analysis. As good as it is, as a method, and I endorse it in that sense, it can't be the be-all and end-all of philosophy. It ends up in subjective subjectivism, a social subjectivism. It doesn't do philosophy in the grand manner. It doesn't give us universal answers to the big questions. And in fact, it ends up with the clarity, which can be questioned for whether it's subjective or objective, and so brings us right back to the beginning of the whole history of philosophy again. How do we know what we know? What is the nature of reality? And how should we live our lives? I certainly do not want religious language to be compartmentalized into just one linguistic community and how they happen to do things. I want to maintain that the language of religion, and particularly the language that God has given us in His inspired Word, is that worldview in terms of which all the problems of philosophy can be answered, not skirted. Or, if you will, it's that worldview in terms of which the internal problems of humanistic autonomous philosophy don't even occur, because there's no problem about how we know what we know, what the nature of reality is, and how we should live our lives. Once God, who knows all things and created this world, including our minds, has declared to us the answer to those questions. And so I certainly don't want ordinary language analysis just to shut me off and say, well, yes, in your evangelical ghetto over there, there is a use for that language. What I want to say, and this is the kerygma, this is the proclamation of the good news in the area to which God has called me to work in philosophy, the good news is Christ saves you from your intellectual problems as well as saves you from everlasting damnation. In philosophy, I want my form of language, the language of Reformed orthodoxy or evangelical commitment, the language that's given to us in the Bible, the worldview that God has delivered to us in His Word to be the context in which all of the major problems in philosophy can now be dealt with. Okay, any questions about ordinary language analysis? Yes, go ahead. I don't think teaching little children had anything to do with him getting back to the basics. I understand where you're going with the question, but it doesn't seem to me that it had anything to do with it. I think it's incidental how he made his living. The point is, it was not a highfalutin scholastic glorious job. It was that it gave him time to reflect on the mistakes and the artificialities of atomism and positivism, so that when he decided to return to philosophy, he now wanted to endorse the richness of our language, ordinary language analysis. All right, in your outline, you will see that I now have listed our cultural crisis. You also know that my time is running very short, and so I'm going to remind you that you have reading assignments in Schaeffer, chapters 9 through 12, 9 through 13, and a concluding postscript, as well as reading in Paul Johnson, Intellect. If we could do all the things we'd like to do, at this point, I would say the history of philosophy that I've had to focus on because of the difficult questions, the more narrowly philosophical issues that come up, the history of philosophy has been not falsified, but distorted somewhat if you don't see it in its cultural context. Because human beings are not just floating, you know, minds that go into a classroom and work on logic problems, you know. Human beings are flesh and blood. They're connected to other human beings. They're connected to the world. They live in a culture. They're part of history. And the value of reading Schaeffer and Johnson is that you'll see that some of these tough questions that have been up on the board, whether it's been Hegel or Husserl or Wittgenstein, whatever it may be, they're part of a zeitgeist, the spirit of the age. And they influence the spirit of the age as well. Given what humanistic, autonomous philosophers have had to tell us about what we know, what is real, and how we should live our lives, it's legitimate for us to look at history and say, what have been the consequences? What's been the cultural fallout from all? And Francis Schaeffer, in particular, points to how non-reason, in any grand manner sense of reasoning, non-reason has entered into philosophy, has influenced theology, and then the art. That non-reason has come to dominate our human approach to value. And that is evident not just in complicated philosophical theories, but it's obvious just when you look at what's in our culture all around us. Schaeffer looks at existentialism and how it has led to mysticism in religion and mysticism in general in our culture. The affirmation of a fragmented approach to reality, the meaninglessness of the art, the affirmation of drug, and then apathy, and in our culture, finally, people living for personal peace and affluence. I mean, these unbelieving theories are not innocuous. They have an effect, and Schaeffer says they are destroying our culture. They're destroying our confidence. They're destroying our morality, our dignity. And so with respect to value, we see non-reason coming to dominate. People willing to use drugs or to get involved in approaches to art, which are totally irrational, chance paintings and so forth. As though we could finally get beyond, you know, the machine of science and affirm our freedom and our human value. And then in the area of rationalism, as it's applied to philosophy, science, and politics, the realm of fact, we see relativism, because science, after all, can't tell us what our ethical values are. Behaviorism, science tells us that we're nothing more but conditioned response mechanisms, advanced white rats, and then that leads to the state being willing to use manipulation. And so Schaeffer tells us, and again, he's not always right on the details. He got Hegel real wrong, I told you that. But it is amazing. God had given to Francis Schaeffer a real sense of the flow of culture and the outcome of these bad philosophies. With respect to value, non-rational. With respect to fact, you get behaviorism, manipulation, and then an authoritarian state. Now, the values that we spoke of just a moment ago are non-rational. So when the authoritarian state starts to, you know, exercise its power, what values can it apply? Are they rational, universal, well-grounded values? No, they're arbitrary values. So communism applies arbitrary values. There's no basis for what communists want to do. And that's why communism so easily has the rhetoric of goodwill toward your neighbor and the practice of oppression. How can you justify the gulags based on a communist view of man and society? Well, when you note that there's no rationality, it's all arbitrary, regardless of what theory you can write out on the board, in actual living fact and culture, communism leads to oppression. Well, but then if you have no rational foundation for your Western approach that is coming out of the Christian worldview, if the liberal tradition in America has no rational foundation, then aren't the values of our society arbitrary as well? Well, yes, they are. And then what happens culturally? Well, then we find ourselves living in a day and age where, to our horror, abortion can be affirmed, homosexual rights can be affirmed. After all, it's different strokes for different folks if you're a relativist. Well, if it's different strokes for different folks, then you really can't hold on to the value of democracy and freedom either, can you? Because for the sake of saving the unity and the order of the state and our economic well-being, Schaefer says, the day will come when the state will take away our freedoms because it's different strokes for different folks, and all that counts really is that you are happy and kept secure. And so freedom, when it doesn't have a Christian foundation, turns out to generate what? Oppression. Whether you look at the communist world with its human values and it becomes a bloodbath in the gulags, or you look at the Western world with its affirmation of freedom that has no rational foundation, it turns into statism and authoritarianism to maintain our way of life. And so no matter where you begin, with communism, you know, the corporate approach, or individualism, the freedom approach, they both end up in authoritarianism and human oppression, a lack of value. Now, I happen to think that's a brilliant insight. It may not be argued with precision. It may not have every detail right. But that is the flow of history. And I just wish I had more time to talk to you about it, because that is also the history of philosophy, the culture that goes with these fallen philosophies. Paul Johnson adds to that, that if you look at the intellectuals who have set themselves up to guide us, to show us the way, and he begins with Rousseau, works through the Romantics and other periods. You're going to finally read about Sartre and Bertrand Russell and then some others beyond them in the 20th century. Johnson says, you see, three things when we study the intellectuals. Right? He didn't say it's three. I'm boiling it down for you quickly. First, you see hypocrisy. You just cannot get away from the hypocrisy. What good are the theories of these intellectuals or these philosophers if, in fact, you can't live them out, and they don't live them out? That's really saying one thing with your mouth and saying another thing with your life. And so, in a sense, hypocrisy is a living contradiction. Secondly, Johnson shows us in a lot of detail the repulsiveness of these men's lives. I mean, even if you took it the anti-intellectual approach and said, I don't want to follow all these complicated theories and refute them, you can say, well, just look at the lives of the people who propose them. There's a repulsiveness about these people that should lead you not to hold them in high esteem. And then thirdly, and this is really important, the deceitfulness of intellectuals. We live in a culture, as the last chapters in that book show you, where intellectuals don't even care about truth in the end. They'll say whatever is necessary to accomplish their end. And that ought to frighten you to death, because no one ever comes out and says, listen, I'm rationalizing. Paul Johnson has caught on to something that we as Christians know even better than he does, and that's that philosophers are human beings, and they are guided by their style of life. People don't first work out their atheism in some cold, abstract way, and then they say, okay, if there is no God, I can live with my girlfriend out of wedlock. People who are living in sin, whether it's sexual sin or other forms, people who are living in sin are not motivated to find the truth. They are deceitful people, and their thinking is therefore a form of rationalization. They come up with worldviews that will enable them to live the way they want to live. And Paul Johnson has isolated in particular illustrations the deceit of modern intellectual culture. And I think that's very helpful. He isn't philosophizing with a hammer, but in that sense, I mean, in what he's saying, we should remember the philosopher with the hammer, Nietzsche. Intellectuals are a bunch of lawyers. Do the people who are defending O.J. Simpson truly in their heart of hearts believe that he's innocent? Well, I don't know. I can't see into their heart of hearts. But I do know, given the amount of money such lawyers make and the way they practice the trade, they would probably tell you it's utterly irrelevant whether he's innocent. There's a job to be done and a lot of money to be made. The ancient world had such intellectuals as well. They were called sophists. The sophists said there is no truth. There is no absolute truth. If there were, you couldn't know it. And even if you could know it, you couldn't communicate it. Utter relativism. And it was against the cultural effects of sophism that Plato and Aristotle tried to develop systematic philosophies of life to save their culture. Of course, not having the grace of God and the revelation of God, they couldn't do it. But that's what they were trying to do. Paul Johnson wants to show us the deceitfulness of modern culture. As Nietzsche said, that intellectuals have their preconceptions that they're rationalizing. They're utter relativists, and this is what is destroying us. There have been many moments along the way in this class, I am sure, where you just thought, this is beyond me, this is a bunch of intellectual nonsense, why should I bother with it? Well, I hope in these remarks that I'm giving you, you see why you should bother with it, why it's important. Maybe you don't want to give your life to the study of philosophy and writing articles in detail about Bertrand Russell, whatever, that's fine. But if you want to understand the world in which you live, and you want to understand the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ, you can hardly do better than to study the history of philosophy. If you want to do any good for your fellow man, you will not do that if you just repeat the errors of the past. It is good to have studied the history of philosophy that we will know that the only hope we have in life and death is the Lord Jesus Christ and what he has shown us in the scriptures. And so that now we can take a world and life view that is not only intellectually adequate, we can now take it to the world and show that it also has transforming power for individuals and for their society. Time prevents a detailed discussion of current trends. But I can at least hope to accomplish this, that those who graduate from my courses or those who pass my courses are not culturally illiterate. And so we cannot study all of the contemporary movements in philosophy in the last 20 years, but I would like to mention a couple of names and a couple of movements that you should at least have some awareness of, should be able to identify them. And so I'll be real quick about this. Two names that I want you to be familiar with are the names Karl Popper, and then Willard Van Orman Quine. Willard Van Orman Quine, Q-U-I-N-E. Karl Popper is an Austrian philosopher, of both the natural and social sciences. He was born in 1902. And as you know from my lecture a few moments ago, he tried to rescue some of the underlying currents in the logical positivist movement, although he was never himself a positivist. He is the one who offered the falsification principle in the place of the verification principle. Popper has had such an impact on modern philosophy, both epistemology and social theory, that, again, if you're going to be culturally literate, you should at least know that name. According to Popper, knowledge should not be looked upon as having foundations in infallible sources of truth. Knowledge should not be seen in a foundationalist framework. That when we know things, that means what we know can be traced back to an infallible source of information, but rather knowledge should be seen in a more pragmatic light, in a more functional light. And so Popper stands in line with John Dewey, if you will, in his critique of the traditional quest for certainty. If we could just get back to sense data, if we could just get back to an infallible revelation, if we could just get back to clear and distinct ideas with rationalism or something. Popper says knowledge does not have foundations like that. That's the wrong metaphor or image to use. According to Popper, we approach the world of experience with propensities, innate propensities. Particularly, when we approach our experience, we have a general expectation that there will be regularity in our experience. Now, is that expectation of regularity logically justified? Popper says, no, it's not. But it is something you can explicate biologically. So, if you will, the way in which we approach the world looking for regularity is a matter of our biological evolution. You can explicate in a biological way why it is we expect our experience to show patterns of regularity. Who are we back to when we start talking this way? Aren't we back to Kant all over again? I mean, we're not getting beyond the skepticism of David Hume. Now what we're doing is saying, okay, I can show you a basis for causal expectation, but it's not a rational basis. It's a what? Well, Kant made it a psychological thing. My mind, applies causal expectation to the world and orders my experience causally. Karl Popper is naturalizing that, making it biological, but we still haven't escaped the skepticism of Hume. So it's no surprise that Karl Popper doesn't think we shouldn't be looking for certainty, because given his worldview, certainty is not available, so why look for it? On the other side of Popper's influence, you need to be aware that he has had quite an influence, especially in England, in his critique of collectivist and authoritarian political regimes. In 1945, he wrote the book The Open Society and Its Enemies. In 1957, The Poverty of Historicism. And here he takes that theory of knowledge that I've only roughly traced for you and applies it to an attack on historicism, the view that there are general laws of historical development that make the course of history inevitable, that if we just know the factors, we can predict the outcome of history. And in The Open Society, he applies this critique to Plato, Hegel, and Marx, showing that these three philosophers and all who fall in their line of thinking are enemies of the open society, the society that believes in freedom and mutual tolerance. The next name that you should be culturally literate enough to recognize is perhaps the leading or best known philosopher in America, and that is Willard Van Orman Quine, professor of philosophy at Harvard, who was born in 1908. Quine should be remembered for making an analytical attack on what is known in the history of philosophy as the analytic-synthetic distinction. Philosophers distinguish between two types of statements. An analytic statement is one that is true in virtue of definitions and the laws of logic. The red barn is red is analytically true. Doesn't tell us anything, though. It doesn't tell us whether there is a red barn, for that matter. But the red barn is red. It doesn't extend our information. And then the synthetic statements are those which tell us something more. If I say the red barn is north of the road, now I've given you more information than what is contained in the concept of red barn. So that is a dogma of empiricism, the analytic-synthetic distinction. And Quine has attacked that to show that you can't hold to this dogma of empiricism on empirical grounds alone, that you have to import into your philosophy something which is utterly illegitimate from an empirical standpoint, and that is a notion of necessity. It's a long story to explain to you, but if you're going to read the classic essays of the 20th century, you would have to read The Two Dogmas of Empiricism by Willard Van Orman Quine, where the analytic-synthetic distinction is undermined. Quine is also known for his view of radical translation. Since he doesn't believe in the metaphysical reality of propositions, unseen entities like that, then he approaches language and the commonality of meaning between two languages not in terms of unseen realities like propositions, but rather in terms of stimulus and response, in terms of behaviorist understanding of human nature. So that the statement in Japanese and the statement in English that we say mean the same thing is explicated in terms of have the same behavioral outcome. You know, the very same things are done in the presence of the stimulus of that sentence, whether it's Japanese or English. So he attempts to regiment translation and language according to, as I've indicated, radical translation, behavioristic translation. According to Quine, we never can know if there's a difference in conceptual scheme between one culture and another with their different languages, because when you approach, let's say, a totally unknown language, you can't ever be sure that you aren't applying your scheme of subject and predicate rather than seeing things in the way that native tribe does, let's say. So you have an experience, you see a rabbit out there, and then you ask the tribesman to give the linguistic appropriate response in the presence of the rabbit. Well, now, when the tribesman does that, is the tribesman telling you the name of the object? Is he telling you the position of the object? Is he telling you the modality that is sitting still, running, jumping? What is he telling you? Well, now, even if you could do more tests and so forth to isolate this word over against that, in the end, you could never know whether an expression is being used for running rabbit, whereas in our language, we'd only be saying rabbit, and then we would add to that run. So the conceptual scheme, even if you get all the behavioristic, you know, translation done so you know what languages are appropriate for translating what expressions are appropriate in one language for translating another, you could never know that you had the same conceptual scheme. Now, over against Quine and views such as that, we could say much more about him. You should thirdly know of the development in the 20th century called structuralism. Structuralism. Basically, we have here the application of research and insights from modern linguistics to various fields beyond the field of linguistics. Structuralism is associated with the pioneering work of Ferdinand de Saussure, Saussure, who worked in general linguistics, and then more particularly, you'll know in our culture, hopefully, the name of Noam Chomsky, Chomsky, who was mentioned, by the way, in Paul Johnson's book. Noam Chomsky, who has done fascinating work in transformational grammar. The person who has applied the linguistic insights of Saussure and Chomsky, perhaps the best known, is Levi Strauss, Levi-Strauss, who has particularly tried to understand sociological structures and movements in light of structuralist linguistics. And boy, I've really got to be over general now, but Noam Chomsky notes that there is in all languages something of a depth grammar. Not all languages have the same grammar, but beyond the grammar of all languages, there is a depth structure that seems to be unavoidable. All languages are committed to that kind of, and demonstrate that kind of depth structure. Well, now this sounds like Immanuel Kant all over again, doesn't it? Kant said the mind has a structure that is applied to human experience and orders it in a certain way, so it's universal. The structuralists are kind of like Kant then, in that language has a depth structure. And this depth structure now can be applied to other fields. Sociology, for instance, can be applied to mythology and music. So on the one hand, Quine says you can never know that there is a common conceptual scheme being used, and then Levi Strauss and Chomsky and others are arguing for a structuralist understanding based on an analysis of language. And then the final development that I want you familiar with is deconstructionism. The deconstructionists don't believe in a depth structure, a depth grammar. They don't believe even in a radical translation. According to the deconstructionists, our linguistic signs have no reference. And this is a radical view. It's the death of all scholarship, the death of culture, in my view. But according to them, the signs that we use in language have no referent outside themselves. To say that something is literary is to say that it encourages misreading. Or, as the motto goes, every reading of a text is a misreading of the text. Every reading is a misreading because there's no center. There's no firm point, no reference that is signified by the text. So every reading is a matter of your subjective interaction with the text. The text is just a springboard that creates something in you. Every interpretation of a text is a misinterpretation of the text because there can be no central, unchanging meaning in a text. The meaning of things is indeterminate, and for that reason, according to the deconstructionist, a literary text deconstructs itself. The text, when you look at it, has within it the elements which will make it impossible for there to be a uniform or universal interpretation. Yes. Yes, you're on the right track, but you're jumping ahead of me. That's the final word is, well, then, if deconstruction is true, you can't express deconstruction. To which their response is, yes, that shows the playfulness of language. It's Ludwig Wittgenstein saying, if you understand what I have told you, it's like a ladder you climbed up that you must now kick away. The deconstructionists would not be able to express themselves if they believed that all language, that all interpretation is a misinterpretation of a text. See, their point is there is nothing outside, no objectivity beyond the text by which an interpretation could be weighed or measured or compared. And obviously, then, there can be no literary canon if you're a deconstructionist. There can't be the grand and classic works of Western culture. Now, do you see the influence of deconstruction in our universities all around us? Of course. How can you say that what every educated person should read is the following? How can there be a canon of the greats of Western literature? Not if there's nothing objective to a text, because things are only viewed as great because of subjective interaction with those texts. So we must banish any canon of literature. We must challenge any kind of binary structure, any kind of structure that says you have this and its opposite. Male, female, get rid of. True, false, get rid of. No binary structures. Because literature takes place, literature is an activity that takes place in a world without truth. And that makes all interpretation a matter of imagination and play. Well, as I've said many times throughout this course, I suppose we can stop and say, well, then how's it going in this humanistic attempt to put the world together without God? Are you real impressed where we end up when the deconstructionists say there is no absolute truth and you can't even communicate because all communication is interpreted as a miscommunication or a misinterpretation? Well, what has happened to rationality? What has happened to value? What has happened to our culture when we've put aside the Word of God? Well, the results speak for themselves. So these are some of the cultural movements of your generation that you shouldn't be so ignorant in a conversation to not identify. You should know the work of Karl Popper, his rejection of foundationalist epistemology, the work of Willard Van Orman Quine and how it leads to the rejection of any underlying conceptual scheme or universal thinking apparatus, the affirmation of that as a depth grammar in the structuralist, and then the final rejection of every referent for a text and deconstructionism. Well, let's take a two-minute break, and then I would like to give you some final words about the whole history of philosophy. All right, I'd like to offer you a concluding assessment, not just for 19th and 20th century philosophy, although it's applicable, but an assessment of the entire history of philosophy, for those of you who have been through it, either here in person or by tape, or those of you who may go back and take the other courses. What would I say as a Christian trying to offer some kind of helpful conclusion about what we've learned in the history of philosophy? I'd like to say three things, and then I'd like to say those three things one more time in a very brief conclusion. That conclusion will be intended to be an encapsulation of what I'm now telling you. First of all, it's impressive to me that throughout the history of philosophy, we end up with what are basically two models of knowledge, or sometimes called two models of science, in terms of a wide generalization, trying to cover all that we've seen from the pre-Socratics down through the structuralist and the deconstructionist. The models of science can be easily classified as foundationalist approaches to knowledge and pragmatic approaches to knowledge. Foundationalism and pragmatism. The foundationalists say we have objective knowledge, we can be sure of what we believe, when our beliefs can be traced back to or established upon the foundation that certifies them. That is, we have some kind of source that gives a guarantee to our beliefs. Now, there are different kinds of foundational sources, though. You have common sense philosophies that say you can finally get certainty when you trace your views back to what is commonsensical. And of course, there are varieties of common sense philosophy, but I'll let you complete the outline. Over against the common sense foundation, in the history of philosophy, you have a perceptual foundationalism that says we can finally get certainty when the things we believe are traced back to a foundation of perception, where I have an immediate experience. Remember from this morning, Bertrand Russell, knowledge by acquaintance, knowledge by description. When we can get back to an acquaintance, when we can get back to a sense data, when we can trace back our thoughts, as Locke said, to some experience through the five senses, then we've reached the foundation of knowledge. So, as one model for science in the history of thought, we have the notion that we can be sure of things by looking for the right foundation, be it common sense or perception. The pragmatic approach, which is especially popular in the 20th century, says, no, knowledge is not a matter of having infallible sources or infallible foundations. Knowledge is a matter of fruitfulness. When we can successfully resolve our problems, then what we believe will be called true, which is to say the whole project of justifying beliefs is naturalized. And that language is significant. You may want to reflect on it. It's naturalized. That is to say, we don't finally get a normative justification for knowledge, we get a description of the outcome of our methods of knowing. And that means that pragmatism, in the end, falls into different schools of, if you will, success in knowing things. How do we naturalize the process or the method of knowing? Are we to look to psychology for the pragmatic model, to biology, to sociology, to anthropology? These are major answers all in the 20th century, in fact, the late 20th century. In an essay that I have available, you know, through our Tate ministry, you can pursue what I've just laid out for you as the models of science with bibliography and examples more. But my point here, and this is the first of my three as I'm wrapping things up, is we as Christians, as we look then at the whole total project and output of autonomous men, in the end, I've got to say, it's rather foolish, isn't it? Because the foundationalists have never been able to find a foundation that will, in fact, certify knowledge. Let's say you take the common sense approach. You know, you don't need to have taken my course to figure this out. What one person calls common sense, another person says, I don't think that's sensible. So how do you resolve any disagreements? How do you get any objective knowledge from an appeal to common sense? If sense were so common, we wouldn't have the history of philosophy. When we try to track knowledge down to perceptual foundations, well, again, you have to have heard the whole chorus, but we've seen that fail over and over and over and over again. In fact, that's something of the driving force of epistemology, the history of philosophy, is that every attempt to have an empirical theory, what did Bertrand Russell end up saying? He said, empiricism's inadequate. All I can tell you is that it's less inadequate than the others. We're dying slower than the others. And if you're going to take the physicist approach, Russell says, it's not because I have an argument for it, it's because you choose to. So much for foundationalism. And then pragmatism, well, even forgetting that you have these different approaches, do you naturalize the knowledge procedure in a biological, anthropological, sociological way? Even forgetting that, no one can ever say that our methods are successful unless you have something outside of the description of success that you're comparing it to. That is, if you don't have objective knowledge, then the discussion of success in reaching our goals is meaningless. So what's our conclusion? Point one, so given all of this time, men who have this proud confidence in their own reasoning ability have never been able to give a justification to their rational procedures. Number two, as we survey the various positions of the philosophers and schools of thought, it should be evident to you that men eventually endorse basic kinds of worldviews, that you don't really have hundreds and hundreds of years of diverse views, but they really fall out ultimately into certain simple basic categories. You have philosophies that are oriented toward permanence, either in epistemology and metaphysics, or their emphasis is upon process and change. You have philosophies that look for unity in things, and they think that's the most important, the monistic urge in philosophy. And then you have those philosophies that say, no, diversity is the most important thing. Let's see if we can illustrate this quickly, since I can't go through all the illustrations in the history of philosophy. Today we looked at language philosophy. Are there two different orientations in language philosophy? One says we want unity. We want the pure ideal language. The other says the diversity of ordinary language is much better. And so on and on through the history of thought. The pre-Socratics, you have those who say, no, it's the unity of reality that is most important. And that's why we shouldn't think that change takes place and you can't trust your senses. On the other end, you say, no, it's the diversity of things. The atomists who say, the one thing you can be very sure of is your senses. You better not trust your reasoning process then. Which way do you go? You go with David Hume, whose images of reality were of billiard balls externally related. You go with Hegel, whose images of reality were the bud folding out to the blossom, developing into the fruit. Process, internal unity, internal relationship, or external relations, and you have diversity. These are recurring patterns in history. And as we've seen, especially in the 19th and 20th centuries, another one of these major divisions in orientation in philosophy is, if you will, the outsider objectivist approach, where the philosopher is like a spectator. He's standing back from the fray and he's evaluating things by rules. And then you have other philosophers who say, no, you need to be a participant in what you're talking about. You need to get actively involved. So you have Plato on the one extreme, who has the philosopher contemplating the eternal forms, and they don't even have anything to do with this changing world because it's unreal, finally. And then you have John Dewey, who says we don't need to talk about any of that nonsense. The question is, are we reforming society? Are we, you know, getting the problems of our environment taken care of? How do you do philosophy? You know, as a spectator, objectively, or you get involved, you become intimately acquainted with it. In the 19th century, we divided the secular stream of thought from the non-cognitivist stream of thought, right? If you were to tell Kierkegaard, you realize, Kierkegaard, that you have not refined the tools of language. You have not been precise in what you want to say. He'd say, who cares about precision? Don't you understand the alienation of human nature? Well, don't you see that without precision you've been led to absurdity? He said, of course, and that's why we make a leap of faith. That's what authentic human existence is all about. Well, then Kierkegaard turns around and he wants to argue with John Stuart Mill. I should say, John Stuart Mill, how can you possibly think you can help culture when you've not done an analysis of human subjectivity? You don't understand human nature. How can you? Mill would say, what on earth are you talking about? What's important is that we can calculate the consequences of legislation so that people are going to have happiness maximized. We need to be more scientific and less subjective. Here's my point. And because I'm a presuppositionalist, I think there is special significance in this. What you learn if you really study the history of philosophy is that philosophical disagreements tend to be inconclusive. Well, that's why there's a history of philosophy, right? One philosopher has one point of view and somebody else comes along and says, no, that's not quite right, or it's altogether wrong, or whatever. And on and on and on and on and on and on it has gone. So your poor hands are worn out hearing poor Dr. Bonson say this theory and this theory and this theory. Why is that? I mean, we should at least stand back at the end and say, why did we have to go through all that? Is there any explanation that can be given? I think so. We note that a concentration of effort by acute and important minds leads not to a consensus at the end of the history of philosophy, but only to such a diversity of opinion that certain schools of thought find it unrewarding, if not absolutely impossible, to communicate with each other or convince each other. They cannot even agree on the rules for resolving their disagreements. Underlying these inconclusive disagreements, I want to argue, are profound differences of worldview. And until we recognize that worldviews control our starting point, our method, and our conclusion in philosophy, until we see that influence of worldview convictions, until we recognize that there are different presuppositions being used by these schools of thought that determine how they do philosophy, we'll never understand the history of philosophy or be able to make progress. You see, the presuppositions of Hegel over against the presuppositions of Hume, the presuppositions of Aristotle over against those of Plato, the presuppositions of Dewey over against the presuppositions of Russell, and on I could give you, they determine what is thought to be puzzling and problematic, what needs explanation. Remember Mill and Hegel? I contrasted them for you. Hegel wanted to know, if you begin with freedom, how can you restrict the individual's freedom and make sure that the state is legitimized? Mill's approach was quite the opposite. If you start with the state having the right to legislate, how can you protect the individual's freedom? You see, they started at different places because their presuppositions were different. They didn't even identify the problems as being the same problems. Secondly, what they began with as initially certain about experience or reality, what their starting point was, would be different depending on their presuppositions. What presupposition did Frege have? I told you explicitly. He said, the clarity that we gain in math makes it a paradigm for all knowledge. And so now everything will be reduced to logical and linguistic analysis. But now if somebody starts with a different presupposition about what is certain, what is clear, then his starting point's going to get him on the road in a different place. Nietzsche did not think that that was helpful. He said everybody's just rationalizing. And what you begin with is instinct, not math. And then thirdly, your presuppositions determine the nature of the analysis that you engage in. That is, your presuppositions tell you what method is appropriate to resolve these problems. And so, as you look at the history of philosophy, every school of thought has some conception of what the problem is, where we start to resolve it, and what method we use. And the reason these schools of thought can't ever get together is because their presuppositions give them a different starting point, a different outlook on what's puzzling about life, and a different method of resolving it. And because they have these different orientations, it turns out that schools of thought talk past each other. They have to eventually, as Wittgenstein said in his book on certainty, in the end, you get down to the bottom of your analysis, and when you can't agree with one another, all you can do is call each other heretic and go on. We can't resolve our problems because they are determined by our presuppositions. Okay, number one, my point was, in the history of philosophy, autonomous men have not been able to come up with a theory of knowledge that is workable and does not contradict itself or become arbitrary. Number two, I've said that the history of philosophy shows that what separates schools of thought and makes it impossible for them to resolve their problems is because they have underlying presuppositional differences, different orientations toward philosophy and life. And then number three is I want to point out that in all unbelieving philosophy, the presuppositions that we've been talking about prove to be dialectic. As Dr. Van Til puts it, there is a rational, irrational movement in all unbelieving philosophy. All unbelieving philosophy in some way wants to be rational. It wants to assume that the universe is capable of description, capable of being known or dealt with. After all, anything that's not rational couldn't be understood anyway. So, to do philosophy, you've got to be committed in some sense to rationality. Well, the problem is, though, that every time you try to rationally understand the universe, when you don't begin with the revelation of God, the scheme of explanation turns out to break down, either to have its own inconsistencies in it or not to be able to account for the wealth of reality out there. It can't account for everything. So you get behavioristic psychology. What a joke! You take, you know, what is true in physics and so useful in physics, try to apply it to human reality, and it just completely tears up human reality. Men are not white rats. You can't explain them that way. So here you have something very rational, but it can't account for everything. Or to use the language of Francis Schaeffer, modern man is a divided field of knowledge. He can't find an explanation that really applies in principle to everything he knows. And so rationalism is necessary. Rationalism is assumed by all philosophers, and yet humanistic rationalism, not based on the revelation of God, can't account for everything and creates its own problems. And so then how do you remedy the breakdown? When rationalism doesn't work, what did Hegel say when the student said, "Herr Professor, the facts don't fit your theory"? He said, "Then the facts be hung." Because they are not rational facts if they don't fit my theory. That's one approach. I've got my scheme for explanation, and everything's going to fit. Van Til puts it this way, what my net doesn't catch ain't fish. If my scheme won't work, then so much the worse for what it doesn't work on, because my scheme is going to be what I'm committed to. Or you can take the other approach, and that is, well, that's a kind of irrationalism to say I'm going to close my eyes and not take account of counterexamples. Or you take the other approach and you say, well, ultimately reality is not knowable by the mind of man, so I would expect my system wouldn't work entirely. That is, every philosophy that we've looked at ultimately admits the limitation of the human mind. It doesn't always willingly admit it. Sometimes it only illustrates it. But every philosophy admits it. And by the way, somebody might say, well, now, wait a minute, Dr. Bonson, there's one example. How about Hegel? But listen to what I said. The limit of the human mind. Hegel had the most grandiose, pompous philosophy that I've ever encountered. But even Hegel said that the moment of rationality of my mind must eventually be swallowed up in the synthesis of the absolute mind. And until we reach the absolute mind, nothing is known for sure. Everything's only an approximation. So even in Hegel, the most pompous of the rationalists, even in Hegel, the limitations of the human mind have to be admitted. And so what do we see in the history of philosophy? What we see is a dialectical dance where men who will not submit to the revelation of God begin to philosophize. What is the nature of reality? How do I know what I know? How should I live my life? So they try to be rational. Rationalism breaks down, and so then they move in the direction of being irrational. Well, nobody can understand the whole of reality anyway. or they'd say, I won't take account of things that don't fit my rational scheme, which is another form of irrationalism. So you go back and forth, back and forth. Why? Because the human mind, I hope you've learned this if you followed the whole history of philosophy, the human mind is not up to the task, to put it in a colloquial expression. The human finite mind cannot produce a worldview that accounts for reality, knowledge, and ethics simultaneously. It cannot account for the oneness of our experience and the manyness of our experience, the unity and the diversity, the objectivity and the subjectivity. It cannot account for the externality of relations and the internality of relations simultaneously. That can only be done in the infinite mind of God. If these generalizations of the history of philosophy have meant anything to you, then you can see my ultimate conclusion has got to be, if you do not start with the worldview that God has graciously given to us in His own self-revelation, philosophy is doomed to failure. Those are my 3 points. I promised you I can give it to you in one encapsulated statement, and this brings us then to the ultimate climax of the history of philosophy, and my final summary, of which this entire course has been an exegesis, is found in 1 Corinthians 1:20. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? And as I say, it's that verse that I have been exegeting and explaining to you in these 3 courses on the history of philosophy. I thank you for your attention.